Deezer Originals. Trailblazers. Xavier Durrani.
Hello, my name is Eddie Temple Morris, and welcome to another episode of Trailblazers, the podcast that goes deep into the lives of some of dance music's most dazzling DJs. And in these strange times of isolation and separation, it falls to me to introduce each episode of the new season. And this episode sees Nick and I talk to Xavier Durrani from Justice in October 2019. This was the first episode recorded overseas, and this was an exciting thing for Nick and I to be in Paris, in the very vibey surroundings of Justice record label Because Music. And this was, of course, recorded before COVID-19, so the devastating effect on the live music scene, of which Justice are such a vibrant part, was not discussed. But lots was. Let's dive in.
Trailblazers.
Our guest is the youngest trailblazer we have ever spoken to. He is part of an electronic duo that defined the noughties and who have influenced as many producers of dance music as their compatriots and management stablemates Daft Punk. They changed the game by breaking rules in a similar way that Prince did when he made Kiss, and they united ravers and rockers in a way not seen since The Prodigy, but they did it with Gallic style and panache. Incredibly, the first thing they ever did remains one of the greatest remixes ever done. Don't tell me you've never thrown your hands in the air and shouted, "We are your friends!" Their show at a sold-out Madison Square Garden in New York City still ranks as one of the greatest musical spectacles of my life. From Justice, Xavier Durrani, très bienvenue.
Bonjour.
A trailblazer.
Bonjour, Eddie. Bonjour, Nick.
nice to have you here, man.
Lovely to see you again, and on your home turf.
Exactly. It's my neighborhood here.
Really?
Yeah. I've been living here like for 20 years.
And I must say, it's a very nice part of Paris, isn't it? There's beautiful cafes and...
Well, it's not the nicest part of Paris, but I love it, and I think that's the case for like everybody that lived here.
Yeah.
It's like, I think it's one of the worst area of Paris, actually.
Is it? Oh, okay.
But somehow when you like spend a lot of time here, like you stay here.
Yeah.
What is the nicest area in Paris then? Is it the bit by the Pompidou Center, the old Jewish quarter? What's it? Is
like,
Le Marais?
Le Marais is nice. And all my friends make fun of me for that. But if I could, I would go and live next to Saint-Germain-des-Prés or something like this, where all the tourists and the bourgeois are. You know
why?
Because I love it.
Because the grandeur of it.
No, but I used to go to university there.
Oh, okay.
And and it's so nice, and there are girls on the streets and shops, and it's like the postcard Paris to me.
Yes.
And all like the tourists like buying like expensive watches in the world can't make me dislike it. It's just nice, you know. But it's not cool. It's not cool to say you want to live there.
Yeah, and so are you a Parisian?
No, like most Parisians, I'm a suburban.
Oh, okay.
Suburbaner, how do you say that?
Suburbanite.
Yes.
Well, so I've done the big intro, and it's traditional that Nick then leads in with the first question before we backtrack into your life.
Exactly. So fantastic to be here, and thank you, you know, for making the time to join us. It's brilliant to have you here. I was wondering, just what is a typical day like for you at the moment? I'm wondering, before you joined us here to do this recording this evening, were you in the studio, or were you talking about other stuff outside of music? Or I just wondered, what's daily life like for you right now?
Well, today I worked, so I was in the studio.
Ah, right.
But it's not a typical day. It depends, like, and I think that's the luxury of being in a band.
Yeah.
And being in a band such as ours is that we have like long periods where we work, then there's going to be long periods where we don't work and do like plenty of other things. Sometimes we're on tour, sometimes we're in the studio, but we have kind of a relaxed work routine.
Okay.
And
talk me through, what would be a typical work routine when you are in sort of recording phase?
Well, when we record, it's like we always like start slowly and relax. And of course, like the last 6 months of making an album is a nightmare of not sleeping and counting every hour we have and we can use to be efficient.
Yeah.
But that's usually just, it's like, okay, 2 years every like 5 or 6 years. So it's kind of okay.
Yeah.
And then we replace this routine by the tour routine,
yes,
which is even worse. So like the tour preparation, generally it's like, I don't know, 8 to 10 months.
Right.
Of like working every day on both, like rehearsing, preparing the music, working on the scenography. And for example, on the last tour, like the 3 last weeks before the first show,
yeah,
I was sleeping an average of like 20 minutes a night. And whoa, I don't know how my,
man.
Like now I think about it and I don't know how it was possible. Like we were like in, our first gig was in Mexico. And we had like, we rented a warehouse for 1 week before the first show to set up everything and continue rehearsing.
Right.
And there was like a flight case,
yeah,
with foam in it. And that was my bed like for one week.
Coffin.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Like I was sleeping on that case and we're just taking turns. So I was going in the case like for 20 minutes. Then it was like the sound guy.
My
then it
God.
Was like the...
That is so intense. And that was, did you say that was before you started at all?
Yeah.
And was that just because of overwork or are you a warrior? You know, was that through anxiety?
No, I think it's because the, like my theory about deadlines, and I think it works pretty much the same for everyone, is that if you have like 10 months to make a project, you will need like 10 months and 2 weeks. You know what I mean? It's always
yes.
the same. It's always like the N plus one
Yeah,
thing.
Right.
So it's always the same. You know, you just like plan because you know you have this amount of time. And of course, you are always like 2 or 3 weeks late. And because you can't be late, you have to compress like 3 weeks into like, I don't know, 5 days. And this is how you end up like sleeping 20 minutes a day.
Something I've experienced over the years in the making of albums, sometimes the very best stuff comes really near the end. Have you
always.
Right.
Yeah.
You found the same, yeah?
And same thing, like I don't really know if it's actually the best stuff or if it's the stuff you like the more because it comes like spontaneously.
Yes.
At a moment you are like almost dying of like listening to the same stuff for like 2 years.
Yep.
And so to you, it sounds like a stroke of genius, but to the people, I think we don't know, it's maybe not always the best. But for us, we always feel we make the best tracks at the end of the of recording
I've
an album.
I've seen this with multiple really successful acts, actually, that some great stuff comes right under the wire, you know, and you'll know when the deadline is, but then you probably might say to your record label, this sample, do you think this could be clearable? But this is like 3 days before you're supposed to hand in your record or something. And
I think that
goes on quite a bit with great artists.
Yeah, and also there's that thing which brings us to the very first Trailblazers that we did with Renart van der Papelera
from
R&S Records. Yeah. He always says the best shit happens between 5 and 6 a.m. It's like, you know, when you're at your, you know, you're in that zone where you haven't slept for ages and you're super, I guess, suggestible. And I think that maybe you're in a zone that's kind of more creative because you're more open, you know, when you've had so little sleep. So good shit can happen, right?
Yeah.
Like I think in my case, like I'm useless past like 4 a.m. And now we know it. So now we stop working. Like at some point we notice that anyway, you become useless also because we make our records on our own, including the mixing.
Oh yeah.
Like when you mix a record and it's been like 10 hours, you've been like trying to mix a song, then you become crazy. So now we know that when it's dinner time, you have to stop. It depends on when you write. It can happen at night that you find good stuff. But for the more technical stuff, now we know that past a certain hour, we need to stop.
That's rare to both produce and mix records. I mean, from personal experience, Tom, who is, I'm in a band called Losers, and when we make records, Tom goes crazy if he has to mix stuff. I mean, he's really good at it, but he hates doing it. And most people do hand it over to you know, because mixing is a different art to production. But it's very rare that you do it. How come that happens? Why has that always been the case?
It's just because most records we like, especially in electronic music. How can I put that together? Like, we noticed that the electronic records that age the best to our ears are the one that sounds a bit peculiar.
Yeah,
wrong. Or they're never the ones that sound the biggest, you know what I mean? Or the cleanest.
Yes.
And same goes with rock and roll, you know, like all the rock records I like the one I still love in terms of like production and everything. They sound amazing, but they don't sound good. You know what I mean?
They're dirty.
They're not perfect.
Yeah.
And the imperfections are part of the beauty of those records. Yeah. It's that kind of thing, maybe.
Yeah, it's like, it's a very cliche thing, but it's true. And I think there's a reason why it's a cliche.
Yeah, man.
And there's a peculiarity that I feel only us can bring to our own music.
Right.
And we're not the best mixers. Like, for example, I would be... I wouldn't mix like the record for somebody else, but for our music, we feel it's important that we do it ourselves. And so far, so good. Like when I listen back to the albums we put out, they are all like a bit quirky.
Yeah.
And we like them like this, you know what I mean? And we're happy that they don't sound like what sounded like big in clubs at the moment.
You've always broken rules, you know, in production. That's what I loved about Justice. You know, and that's why I drew the parallel between you and Kiss by Prince. When Prince made Kiss, that overloaded snare, that, you know, that sound, like everyone said, that's crazy, you can't do that. That's an overloaded snare. You're insane, you know, releasing this. But that's that wrongness, that sort of dirt, the imperfection was what made it so great.
Yeah, but for, like you say, we break the rule, but for us, it's a rule. And it seems pretty clear when you look back at things that, like, the best records are, like, they have something peculiar, you know. And Kiss is a great example because, like, all the records from this era, I love them because they sound a bit unmixed in a way. They sound like everything is, like, has been put flat on a table, on the desk. And of course, like, it might not be the case, but there's like something like very dry about them and very like unfinished that I really love. Like, and even when I talk about like the Prince albums of this era and the first ones, or when people ask me, okay, what period of Prince do you like? I always say I like the demo Prince, you know, like all the songs he makes, where you can feel like he's making everything on his own. Mm-hmm. And the mixing is a bit like very not flat but like dry, and I love it.
I could carry on this conversation right here for hours, but what I want to do is to wind it back and let's come back to here. So I want to take us back right to where it began, to your suburb of Paris, to where you were growing up. And, you know, did you have a musical childhood? What was your first kind of musical awakening, if I can ask that?
Well, my parents, I think they used to own like maybe 4 records, so it didn't come from them. A big part of it is of my musical education. It like comes from TV when I was young, and like maybe when I was like 20 years old, I realized how important it was, like all those like TV themes from like a series. Like all the American series, like for example, like Silver Spoons or all this kind of stuff that sound a lot like just like a 70s soft rock, got really like printed in my brain, and is the same for Gaspard. And also like all the Japanese anime we used to watch, and especially one, and I put one of the track in my playlist. It's called Cobra. And Cobra was like designed after Jean-Paul Belmondo. And so we were watching this when we were like maybe like 6-8 years old. And the music we make, it sounds like Cobra, you know, from this period. And even our taste in like visuals, like even in girls, I might say, because like everything looked perfect in this anime, like the styles of the guys, like the way they were talking. And it's crazy. Like, this is why now, as a parent, I pay a lot of attention to what my daughter is like watching or listening to, because I know that at this age, you get like so influenced and it stays with you forever.
Right.
Yeah.
So would now be a time, should we listen to Cobra now?
Yeah, we can. Like, it's a very short track.
Yeah, let's get a sense of this.
So who's the artist and what's...
It's like, I don't know, I would be unable to say. I think it's some Japanese guy.
Japanese guy.
Yeah. But it will make sense for you when you listen to it.
All right.
Like how close it is to our music.
So it's from an anime TV show that you watched when you were six?
Yeah.
let's listen.
Let's check it out. Trailblazers. Xavier Durone.
That is hilarious to me, because that is the blueprint. That is just like a blueprint. It's so close, isn't it?
Yeah, like, but it's fun because it took us a lot of time to realize that so many things were coming from our childhood.
Yeah.
And
that really did imprint on you, didn't it? That's crazy how inspirational that turned out to be.
Yeah, but even visually, like I remember like an episode of this anime where, like, to open like a secret gate, he has to play a Serge Gainsbourg track on an organ that makes like glow and lightning when he presses the touches and everything. Mm. And he's playing like Initials BB, I think. But you can't fight against like the childhood memories and everything. It's like,
yeah.
So did you have, you say your parents weren't really big into music, so you didn't have a lot of, you weren't surrounded by music, it came from outside of your home.
This, and also from my older brother. I have a brother that is like 7 years older than me.
Yeah. Mm.
And he played a big role too, because he was listening to like punk rock and rap at the time. Mm. And all sorts of like alternative things. He was like anti, you know, it was like the late 80s. And I think at the time, like the teenagers had a very big affirmation by the music they were listening to. Mm. So my brother was really like into all these kind of like non-mainstream things. Right. So I grew up like both on like the most mainstream things that were like TV. Uh-huh. And MTV, and also like the things that he was like feeding me to. Mm. And for example, I was listening to rap from the age of like maybe 9 years old, and that was because of him.
Right.
And like listening to rap was a very big part also of my musical education.
That's a very French thing, isn't it? French youth have always really been into that expression of urban folk music from America, you know, that like rap music, and taken that ball and run with it very well.
Mm. Which kind of rap records were you listening to?
So it was both French rap.
Yes.
And West Coast rap. Like, I was really into like G-Funk. Yeah.
Yeah. Warren G or whatever.
Like the more like gangster, the better.
Really?
For me. So that's why I was not listening, for example, to New York rap.
Okay.
Like for example, I've never listened to Tribe Called Quest in my life.
Right.
And I know the classics, and I with the time I can like enjoy them. But I've always been more into like the club rap, what I call club rap. And,
right.
And the first CD I bought was Doggy Style.
Right.
And to this day, it's still one of my favorite records. Ever.
And in terms of French rap, was MC Solar too overground for you? Were you like, you know, more subterranean than that?
Well, it's that simple. MC Solar is like a Tribe Called Quest.
Yeah, right.
It's some sort of like conscious, wise, like rap of wisdom, you know what I mean? Mm. Like maybe because I was like a kid in like, you know, like kind of like okay suburb.
Yeah.
I was really into like all I wanted to hear and see was like guys with like guns and talking about drugs and
right. You wanted and the hustlers. Thug. It was the thuggish, the thug end of rap that you liked.
Yeah, but like the reason why I bought like Doggy Style as the first album, it's because that was like What's My Name on the radio, so that was a huge hit.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was just like released from prison for homicide, and that's fascinating. And I think it was probably part of like the marketing plan of the record company.
Yeah.
To make sure everybody knew about it.
Okay, I can just imagine them sitting around the table. Right, so when's the homicide scheduled for? Okay, that's good. All right, and then he should be released by when? Sorry, can we get a lawyer on the phone?
No, but that's fascinating when you're a kid, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you want like some sort of like subversion or things that are unusual to you.
Yes.
And the attitude and everything was still amazing.
All right.
And is there a record from that period that you wanna play for us?
Yeah, like on the stick, I put like a G Funk intro of a Doggy Style. So it's the second track, but the first track is just him in a bathtub. So it's the first moment of music in the record. And I mean, I could have picked like any track of this album.
Yeah,
but this one I chose because the. Like most songs of Doggy Style, it's a mashup between like two or three songs of Parliament Funkadelic.
Yeah.
And because of this record, it brought me to listen to Funkadelic and Parliament.
Trailblazers, Xavier Derone.
It's definitely something in the bass line there going on that was influential to you. And like you say, going on to Parliament and Funkadelic, you know, because that became a really signature part of the Justice sound, was that kind of that really funked bass.
It sounds like it opened a door for you, that record. How old were you when you bought your first... So you bought this on CD, I guess, did you?
Yeah, I bought a CD and it was like in 1992, I guess, so I was 10 years old.
10 years old, yeah. Okay. And then so the doors open and then, yeah, you for the first time you encounter Funkadelic and George Clinton, etc., all that kind of stuff, is that right?
Yeah, from this and because of my brother, I understand that people are making records by taking parts of other records.
Yeah. Mm.
And also because at this time there was no internet... It was such a joy when you were like buying a record and you were recognizing something that you've heard in another record. It was like you found like a, it was like a treasure, you know? So yeah. I started like buying like those like Funkadelic albums, but I didn't have like, how do you say in English, pocket money when I was a kid.
Yeah. Right.
So it was very rare that I would go and buy records, CDs, I would say. And because... You couldn't like listen to them before you were buying them, like the CDs. When you were buying one, you had to stick with it. And even if you didn't like it, you had like to get into it.
You did, yeah. It's an interesting memory, of course, which is, you know, completely different way of consuming music to what we've got now, where now it just, 30 seconds, 20 seconds, next. No financial investment. But yes, if you'd saved up your pocket money... Back when I was a kid, if you'd saved it up to buy a record, you weren't just moving on to something else after 30 seconds. You were going, I'm
love that record. I'm going again and again and again.
And like you said, and even if they were tracks that you weren't so keen on, you were sort of forced to get to know it and love it because you didn't have a plethora of records around necessarily that you purchased because. For obvious reasons.
So true.
But that had some good because like the first Funkadelic album I bought was Uncle Jam Wants You.
Mm. Right.
Because it was cheaper, that was the reason. Because there's like less songs on it. It was not the price of a full record. I think there's only like, I can't remember if that's 6 or 8 songs on it. And I didn't like it, so I bought it, and I was very disappointed because I was hoping like to find some sort of like Snoop, Dr. Dre flavors.
Mm.
And this is, for most part of it, actually a rock record.
Mm.
Yeah. Like the two first tracks are like kind of like disco funk. But that's the thing I didn't know is that if I like Parliament was more like on the funk side of it, and Funkadelic is like mostly like a prog rock band, like psychedelic rock band for me. But the good thing is that I didn't like it, but I had it and it was my my CD, so I played it over and over. And now my favorite funkadelic tracks are like the most like rock tracks, you know what I mean? Like the like for example on this album, my two favorite songs are the ballad at the end that's called Holly Wants to Go to California.
Yeah.
And one that's called Feel Maneuver that I put on the playlist. And sometimes I wish, like even today, I love like being able to listen to whatever I want to, just by like taking my phone and typing a name, like almost everything. But I wish I was like trapped with also some music and I didn't have a choice, but like to go and listen to it over and over until I find something I can hang on to, you know. Of course, like sometimes I would buy a shit record too, and and it wouldn't work. But I feel that we tend not to give a chance to records that are not immediate. And for me, one of the best quality that you can find in music or in art in general is that things that are like a bit opaque at the beginning, and that you finally like manage like to penetrate into. Mm-hmm. And when you do and when it works, it's like it's the best, you know.
Yeah.
And the world of today gives us less opportunities of doing that.
You've reminded me of my favorite album, my Desert Island album, which is by Steely Dan. And, you know, opaque, it takes a while to get into it. Like, what's your... I have this notion of a desert island record, and I want to ask you what yours is. This means that if you had to listen to only one album for the rest of your life, if you're stuck on a desert island with only one album, what would that be? It's a really tough question. And I want to ask Nick, I want to ask you the same thing.
My God.
I mean,
it's so fun. Tough. It's fun because the Steely Dan song almost made it into my.
Really?
Yeah. Ah.
Which one?
Peg, of course.
Oh, Peg. Oh, wow, you say, of course. Yeah, I'm more of an Asia man, you see. So my album is Asia. So, you know, after that.
And a Desert Island record, I think I would put Electric Warrior by T-Rex.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great record.
I don't know. Give me some more time to think about that. That's a really pressured question. I tell you what, while I start to chew on that a little bit, shall we have a listen to the track that you referenced just then? So this was, so you went from the Snoop Dogg record in, and what was the one
it was
that...
a Funkadelic album
it's
track.
It's a Field Maneuver from Funkadelic, yeah.
Trailblazers. Xavier Derone.
It's almost like dance music doing Led Zeppelin, that, isn't it?
It's pretty interesting, isn't it? So now you're 12, 13, this kind of zone?
Like this, yeah.
And has the penny dropped for you yet that you want to be in music, that you want to create music and you want to be involved? Or does that come a little bit later? When you're this kind of age, are you listening to these records but you're thinking, yeah, but I'd still kind of like to be a fireman or a train driver or whatever?
No, like that, like the wish of making music has come like very late for us.
Really?
Yeah, maybe around the age of like 22, something like
22?
This.
22?
Right. I thought that was the case.
Right.
So I'm interested to know, you were absorbing music through your brother and through TV and I guess radio. Were you involved in music in a real way at any stage in your childhood? Like, did you play an instrument? Did your parents get you to play the keyboard or the piano or the guitar or something?
Yeah. Of course, like most like nerds of our time.
Mm.
And I'm talking in the name of Gaspar too, because we had the same experience. We were like playing in like high school bands. So I learned to play like the guitar and the bass.
Mm.
And I was playing in these sorts of like bands because at the time everybody wanted to play the guitar.
Yeah.
So you would like meet in the weekend with like five other guys playing the guitar, there would be like no drummer or whatever.
Yeah.
And
what did Gaspar play?
And he played the drums, actually.
Right.
And a bit of keyboard, but he's been traumatized by his like piano lessons when he was a kid.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah. And we were doing like stuff. Like I was playing music when I was learning the guitar. Not that I liked necessarily, but that was interesting to play when you are learning how to play the guitar.
Right.
So we were doing covers of like, I don't know, like Joe Satriani.
Yeah.
Like I knew how to play Surfing with the Alien, both like the solo part and the rhythmic part, but also stuff like metal and everything. And but that's the thing also for the kids of our time, like you were listening to rap, but we are also listening like to like hard rock and rock, and like Nirvana was so big that it was impossible to escape it.
Mm.
And still to this day, I like Nirvana reasonably. We're listening to like Rage Against the Machine, of course, like all these kind of uh-huh. things.
And when you say, I'm interested to know, when you say metal, what does a French suburban kid mean by metal?
Like Slayer, Cannibal Corpse, and all these kind of things.
Proper metal, okay. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we're listening to that too. It was so fascinating. Like this is alien music, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
I think like you couldn't find stranger music than this, you know.
Yeah.
So let's say when you were 16, 17, 18, this kind of zone, what did you think you might do with your life if the penny hadn't dropped that it was music? In an alternate universe, what would you have ended up doing?
So when I was like 15 or 16, I wanted to become an anesthetist.
Anesthetist? That really?
Yeah, like the people who like make people sleep before operation.
Right, okay.
But just because like my father was working in a hospital.
Okay.
And so I knew I had like a good source. So my father who told me, like those guys, they work like very limited amount of hours every week because it's a stressful job.
Yeah.
And you have like a good paycheck. And so I've always been like looking for like a good ratio between like the time you spend doing something and the return.
Life work.
Yeah, that's quite interesting.
Then I wanted to become like a, I don't know how you say in English, fortune teller.
Really? Yeah,
like
that's it.
Medium.
Yeah.
Wow.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. And why? How come? Are you particularly sensitive and empathic? And
yeah, because I had like some skills at that.
Do you still have some fortune telling skills?
No, it's been a long time.
If you looked at
like
my palm now, would you be able to? Yes, you will.
No, it's like it could be a long story, but
okay.
Like,
interesting though.
But I had like it, had like, and I knew that being a good fortune teller was also being able like to listen to people.
Yes.
And being able to talk to them. You don't go to the fortune teller to know what's going to happen, but just to be like reassured about the options you have.
Right.
It's a bit like therapy.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I said, are you a very empathic person? You know,
I hope I am. I hope. Yeah. And then I was about, like, after the high school, I was about to go to a law university.
Right.
And my brother, who knew, because he had made the law university, he knew it wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
So he put me on a, I don't know the word in English, subscribing like to like one of the big school of art in Paris.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
But you had to, there was a contest, like an entry contest.
Oh, yeah.
Before applying.
An exam. Yeah. An exam.
And he got me there, and I passed the exam. So I moved from my parents when I was 16 years old to go and live in Paris and go to the art school.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And until like the last year of my university, this is when I met Gaspard and we started making music together.
Hmm.
I thought I would become a graphic designer.
Right. Got it.
And Gaspard as well was
exactly the same. Yeah.
Yeah. And was he from a similar neighborhood to you as well? Were you from similar area or?
No, it was closer to Paris.
Yeah.
In like a very nice suburb, like a posh suburb.
Right. Okay.
So tell me, was this around the zone that you first went out to clubs and absorbed the power of electronic music when you were a student? You know, you were maybe like 18, 19-ish, and Am I right? Were you?
But we never really went into clubs with Gaspar, and we were not interested in electronic music,
right?
At all. Like what we liked with the electronic instruments is that we were able like to make a record from A to Z in a bedroom,
right?
But the electronic music was not like something that really interested us.
So you weren't involved in DJ culture and all of that?
Not at all.
You didn't have a big awakening into electronic music. You were just you were a rocker.
Yeah, but because we were too late, like the people who had that were people that were adults in the 90s and we went to raves and stuff like this. Mm. But we were just after that. And so we were listening to electronic music because there were some hits on MTV. Like the first like vinyl I bought when I was like, because I had a turntable, was a Smack My Bitch Up.
Was it?
Yeah, wow, okay. Which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
But it was because it was a hit.
Yes.
And for us, and because Gaspard was really into like the Prodigy too, it was not because it was electronic music, but it's just because it was like it was a hit and the music was good. So we didn't really think about, what is this? Like, what does it represent?
Right.
We loved, like, the way the guys looked.
Yeah.
We loved the music. Like, the video was great.
Yeah.
So you buy and you just listen to that.
And I guess that you loved the fact that it was, even unconsciously, loved the fact that it's the grey area between dance music and rock music. It's both and neither, which kind of, you know, it was provided you with a blueprint in a way.
I don't really know because to me, there's not so many successful blends between rock and electronic music. Mm. Like there happened to be one of them, but I don't know if it was what was happening in our brain, you know, because there's been like a very big wave of like electro rock music after that. Mm-hmm. And most of it, we don't like it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it was just good. And that was enough when you were a kid to...
Yeah.
Good with attitude.
I should say, I mentioned to Liam yesterday that I was coming over to do this. He did say, pass on his regards. So
yeah,
please say hi to him. I will. I'll pass that on as well.
So you're now at art college. You're not into electronic music. You've met Gaspar. What was the point at which you entered, you know, music? Was it, I mean, the legend is that you entered the remix competition that Simeon, who were my chums, who I was, you know, championing on XFM at the time, they had this remix competition for their track Never Be Alone. And it was the early days of, it was something that we, you know, that we kind of helped pioneer together, like our people like us. We were encouraging people at home to do homemade mashups and remixes and stuff, and putting, you know, when I had my first compilation album, I did a remix competition, put separates up online. It was the very early days of that. Was that your very first foray into making music, or had you made music with Gaspar in some way before then?
No, when I made Gaspar, like we were like making music on like separately. Like we had like some equipment and we were trying things, but this track is like the, I can't remember if it's the first one or the second one we made together.
Mm.
Because we made two tracks at the same time. There was one that we made for, like we had some friends that were doing a compilation, so we were making one for them.
Uh-huh.
And we made this other one in parallel. But yeah, it's like the first finished track we've made. I had like this equipment, like it was not a lot of things. I had like a Akai sampler, a few like how do you call that? Expanders, you know, like small machines that have like sounds in it.
Yeah,
a manual sequencer, and we had no computer. And I bought this because I liked being surrounded by these machines.
Yeah.
I was living in a flat in Paris and I liked just to see them and just to be able like to tweak them a bit. And same thing, Gaspard had like a four tracks recorder and a few synthesizers. and we put everything together, but with close to no club influence. And like there was two club things that we both liked. That was Les Rythmes Digital, like the Jacques Leconte.
Stuart, dear Stuart, yeah.
Wall of Sound, right?
Wall of Sound, that's right, yeah.
Like Dark Dancer,
brilliant.
Was like an amazing record to us. And there was this other thing that it's a French guy that's called Alain Brax. I'm seeing a poster of Stardust.
As in Fred Falcon. Yeah. Amazing. Brilliant producer. Yeah, he's done some of my favorite. One of my favorite remixes, actually.
I think in like 1999 or 2000, he made a track with Fred Falk that's called the Intro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I heard this track, I really felt, maybe for the first time, that there was something to be made with electronic music or with dance music, in the sense that, unlike the Prodigy, it's not structured like a radio track. You know, it's one loop and it's like a... He just like rinses the loop from the beginning to the end, but it was still very like emotional and a bit like elegant, but dark at the same time. And I put it on my playlist because like to this day for both of us, it's like probably the best proper dance music track that has ever been made in France. You know, or for example, like for us.
Great. All right, let's give it a listen right now. Trailblazers, Xavier Durone.
That's a fantastic record, isn't it?
It is. It was on Roulet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think that one.
No, it was on the Vulture
record. Which was his record label, Alan's record label, Vulture.
Right.
And yeah, the bass line there, you can see how that might be very sort of influential on you. And there's this Gallic, it's got that Gallic bottom end, you know, that lovely thumping, Daft Punk style, Etienne de Crécy style, like Vulture style kick drum. Mm. Absolutely fantastic. What a great record.
Yeah, man.
So it's how interesting that your entry points into dance music were so late. And so maybe that's why, you know, you sounded so fresh because it's now a legend that, you know, you did this remix, you handed it in with all of these other people. And I remember that Simeon, that Jas and James and all of those guys were on the road at the time and they were listening on a laptop. And that's why you didn't win the competition. I don't even know if you know this, but
I heard that James Ford said that it sounded like MIDI jazz to him. And I have to give him that it's kind of fun and kind of true, you know what I mean?
Well, I see, I've talked to them about this at the time and afterwards, because I helped them with that competition. You know, I helped to get people to do these remixes and stuff via the radio. And because they were listening on a laptop, they missed the whole bottom end of your remix. They just didn't, because you don't hear anything on a laptop. You only hear the top sort of third of it. Mm. So the only reason that you lost that remix competition was because they were listening on a laptop. But of course, then who was it who got hold of it? Was it international DJ Gigolos?
It was Pedro.
It was Pedro that got hold
of it.
Yeah, it was Ed Banger. Because I remember I first saw it crop up as a promo 12-inch single on international DJ Gigolos.
Yeah, like Ed Banger signed it first, but he was like Pedro was starting his label and we were the second record to come out on the label. And it was like working reasonably for a new label, you know, like, and DJ Hell heard the track and re-released it on Gigolo.
Ah.
And this helped a lot, the track. And this is also when we started to DJ, because he had like a booking agency at Gigolo. And so we signed there and we started like to DJ like maybe like 5 days a week. So we played in the whole of Germany. We're playing in like rave parties in caverns at like 9 a.m. So like from nothing, we went like to the most extreme club plans possible.
Wow. So that was a very swift process, was it? From like never having DJed in a club before to then, wow, we're in some crazy place. And
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
How did Pedro, if you didn't win that competition, how did Pedro get hold of it?
Because we met him during a dinner, like a very good friend of us that also designed our first album covers and all the visuals at the time. He was already working for Pedro. And he introduced us to Pedro and said, so I hear you guys are making music. And we're like, no, like we just made like two tracks for the moment.
Yeah.
I said, oh, can I listen to them? So we played him like the tracks we had, including Never Be Alone, We Are Your Friends. And we tell him, but don't worry, like we made that, but we can make better.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, it's cool. I take this one. and he played it. And at the beginning, it didn't really work.
Yeah.
It was okay, you know, but it didn't change our lives. And people were not going crazy when they were listening to this.
Yeah.
And it took like 2-3 years for the track to go onto the surface, which is exactly the 2-3 years we had like to train a bit like DJ, making other music and everything. So finally, at the moment the track got noticed, we are also a bit more ready to do things. So it was a good timing.
Trailblazers, Xavier Derone.
Want to hear more of the music?
Don't forget, you can listen to the tracks in full by heading over to Deezer.com.
Where you'll also find special Trailblazers playlists.
Deezer Originals.
Well, so there it is. Never Be Alone, which everyone knows as We Are Your Friends, of course. And it turned out to be like the anthem of the noughties. You know, it was like, it was, there are so many kids like at university around then, and it's their favorite song, you know. And how interesting that you say that there was a 3-year period,
yeah,
where that was just it wasn't a hot record. It was just kind of, you know, it came out and didn't really get noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And so what were you doing in those 3 years? And what you'd been signed to Ed Banger in that 3-year period, so.
So yeah, we were doing remixes. We were like DJing a lot, and it's fun, like because like the first time we met DJ Hell, so we played in Munich, and that was the first time we were playing out of France. And I think it was the second time of my life I was taking a plane. So we came like to the airport with Gaspard. We didn't know what to do or where to go, and we were carrying like vinyl cases.
Mm.
And so we played in this party, and it was so good. And we're not like, and we're playing with vinyl, so it was all very rough. But the audience was really into it, and they were like doing mosh pits and everything. Was kind of unusual at the time for like, at least it was not what we were expecting from like a DJ set, you know what I mean, reaction.
Mm.
And at the end of the set, we played a track by Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
And that was like Hell next to us, like dancing. And he was saying like, what is this? It's like so good. And we're like, wow, DJ Hell like has never heard of Rage Against the Machine before. It was like, it was a good memory. And from then, I think it's because Hell saw us playing there that he put us in his like a booking agency.
Right.
So yeah, kind of fun.
Yeah, wow. I mean, those were incredible days. And you were doing gigs with Steph and Dave Sol from Solwax, and with Errol Alkan. And this scene was really like, you kicked off a scene, man. You know, people were sort of, I remember producers, kids that I was hanging around with, you know, and fader pushers and tweak heads, and they were abandoning the music as soon as they heard what you were doing. They kind of wanted everything to sound filthy and funky at the same time. Like there was a real scene, and to have that, it was a real, like I say, a gray area between dance and rock, you know, where you can play. Rage Against the Machine, or anything that's like really like balls to the wall rock in a dance set. Glory, glory days.
Very, very exciting. And then, so I suppose you started to have a vision for your first proper artist album at that point, I guess.
Not really,
no?
Not really, no, okay. Because we're like trying all sorts of things. And I take an occasion to big up Errol and the Solwax too, because they really like mentored us. Like they really took us under their wing and were touring with them all the time. Mm. And it was great. Like they taught us like so many things. And I guess the way we were naturally inclined to DJ in a bit the same way, but they really taught us how to do it well.
Mm.
So it was very good.
They were very well, especially for me, Steph and Dave. So inspiring.
Yeah,
there are no rules. You can play anything. You can mix anything together. You can just go for it.
And maybe even more Errol to a certain way,
mm.
because Dave and Steph has like this science of like making things immediately efficient.
Yeah.
And Errol is like more like was more willing to take risks and was never afraid of like taking 1 hour to build up something that only gets people crazy at the last like 10 yes, or 30 right. minutes, you
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah, it's more of a techno thing that was happening with
Dave
him.
And Steph was like, they start on and it's crazy from the beginning to the
yeah,
end.
Yeah.
And Errol has always been for me more like left wing in a way, you know what I mean? Like
more dynamics.
More dynamics, less tracks that you know, less bangers, you know. And,
yeah, yeah, he would play cool records. But then Errol knew when to drop a classic. Yeah. You know, he really good at that.
But both were amazing to us and very, very, we learned so many things with them. And at the time, because we started without a computer, we bought a computer. And this is when we started like to understand what you can do with a computer that you would never be able to make with like analog stuff.
Mm.
And it was really important, this. And so to illustrate like this thing, I put like 2 tracks. One of them is by a French guy called Jackson and his computer band.
Yes.
He was signed to Warp at the time. And this is a laptop music. And the first time we heard it, we are really shocked, you know what I mean? It's like, because it sounded like nothing we heard before and like very like robotic, but very lively at the same time, very romantic, but aggressive. And the other one is a Prodigy track, actually, from the Always Outnumbered, Never Again record.
Right.
That we loved and that to me sounds a lot like laptop music too.
Which one?
I don't know if I put Girls or The Way It Is. Girls. And it's fun because like afterwards, like a lot of people were thinking, so like this French scene, like where does it come from? Is it like from the French Touch or whatever? But the truth is that everybody who heard like this Prodigy album at the time and Jackson, like if you put the 2 together, like the addition, like the math is quite simple because it sounds a lot like this, all like chopped up and aggressive and digital. And so, yeah, I think that like for me, that those are like the 2 touchstones of this period, you know?
All right. So let's first listen to, so it's Jackson.
Yeah.
Jackson is and his computer band.
All right, let's check that out.
Trailblazers, Xavier Derone.
Again, there's a real link that you can hear the link between that record and your style of making music. The Prodigy's Girls, less so, but of course there's a strong parallel between the Prodigy's live show and your live show, which we will come to, which is it's shock and awe, it's lights and it's rock. It rocks every bit as much as any kind of metal rock gig, and it gives you a sense of togetherness of like a of a rave, and that's a space that the Prodigy have always occupied, and that you occupy in your own stylish way.
Mm. Well, I'd like to talk about the live side. So, how about we quick listen to the Prodigy cut, and then let's talk about Just East Live.
goes around the world.
Trailblazers.
So that brings us to the live experience, and really how you structure it, what you want to achieve, what's important to you when you play live. Just talk me through what you're thinking about when it comes to addressing the whole area of representing what you do in a live context.
Well, the thing is that with live, at the time we were DJing a lot.
Yeah.
And there was there's still a huge difference between what we DJ when we DJ and the music we put out. Because even now when we DJ, we don't play so many of our tracks. We don't play so many things that sound like our tracks. And we can play everything from Gabber to '60s rock to pop songs to rap. And we felt, okay, maybe it's time to do something on stage that is we're thinking, okay, I'm putting it as I'm talking. We're thinking of people who came to see us because they heard two or three tracks and how lost they could be when they were hearing what we're DJing. So we were okay, let's make some live shows, and that could be a closer to our record. And for us, the playing a live show is a good opportunity of catching people's attention without necessarily making them dance. Mm-hmm. And it's we've always been very surprised by the reactions at our shows, or the memory people have of our shows, because it's to us it's not that rocking, you know what I mean? And it's very cold, on we're just the two of us on stage, we're almost invisible on stage. The music is not that danceable. It can be kind of not abstract, but we play some tracks, for example, when we perform them live, we play them in a way that people can't expect when it's gonna drop, right, or when it's gonna stop.
Right, right, right.
And everybody knows that the key to make people dance is that they can expect when it's gonna drop. I mean, if you want a track to work in a club, you just have to organize it in a way that people can predict every move of the track, and that's how it works. Mm. And we love to do that when we DJ. And the live, we know that people are not gonna leave anyway, so we like to take this window, to try other things. So now we have those three different poles of justice. There's the justice that make records that are definitely not adapted to any sort of public representation. We have the DJ that is party music, and it's cool, it's fun, and it goes a bit in all directions.
Right.
And the live shows that is another vision of our music that is inseparable from the visual aspect of it too, and that is more a global experience. You're not gonna dance for 1 hour and a half. There will be moments, but there also will be moments where you're just gonna listen to the music and look at it. Mm. I would say the energy is very different from the Prodigy, for example.
Right.
It's completely almost the opposite in a sense.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more dynamics. You know, the Prodigy is an incessant, massive rock rave thing going on, whereas there's so much chiaroscuro, the Italians say, in art. You know, there's so much light and dark. And actually, when you mentioned, the unpredictable reactions that you would get from your crowd. I remember a particular reaction to, you were always very good at deconstructing your records when you played them live. So you'd play D-A-N-C-E, which we know as a jaunty kind of dance track, but you deconstructed it to just a cappella. And the crowd went absolutely bananas. And it was an a cappella, your own a cappella. And you would rinse it for ages and ages and ages. And people would go, like there'd be a riot.
So maybe we had a technical issue on this day. that could explain why. But DNC is a good example, because at the time we started touring, it was probably our most famous track, and we were playing it like very early at the beginning, and in a non-danceable way.
Mm. Yeah.
But just because we felt it felt good at this moment, and too bad if people don't really get what they want. And we still do, we always play it very early.
Yeah.
Not because we want to get rid of it, but but because it's for us, we try to use every bit of famous tracks we have to make the rest bearable. So we know that if we use the vocals of this track,
yeah,
then we can it gives us a window of 5 minutes after that where we can put more difficult things.
Yeah.
Right. And it's okay, people are gonna stay. And we do the same when we DJ, you play one track, everybody's happy. So you have a small window to put something impossible.
Something really, yeah, really cool.
Yeah, and then you take them back again.
Yeah.
So we're talking about live, and we're talking about this sort of audio-visual representation of you. Talk to me about the cross. Whose idea was that? Where did that come from?
It was Somi's idea. So the friend I was talking about earlier.
Right. The design. Did you say a designer, guy? Yeah. Yeah.
And he was our flatmate at the time, and he introduced us to Pedro. And when we bought a computer, the first track we made was Waters of Nazareth. Mm. And it was crazy for us, because this is really the result of discovering something new, is that we were making a track. And then we started isolated the silence between the notes of the synthesizer we were playing, and because it was an analog synth, there was a lot of static noise, and we normalized it, so it became very loud. And then we started distorting it and just trying the plugins that were given with a Cubase, so that was the software, and for the first time we were able to cut things and to place them exactly how we wanted to. And so this track is really made from the static noise between in a synth take for another track.
Right.
And
it's made from what some people would call silence.
Yeah, that's
very John Cage.
Yeah.
That is very John Cage.
In a way. And at the time we were listening a lot to the White Stripes. And so the idea, for example, of having the floor tom, on the intro, on all the times. And also the idea that things can sound so crass, but it doesn't matter. If it's good, people are going to like it. Mm-hmm. And for example, I've always liked this band because of the aesthetic more than anything else, because it's classic blues rock for most part of it. But because there was only drums and guitar, and there are just two of them, and they have to fill the space, if it's a big band. I have a soft spot for two people's band, Death from Above or all these kind of bands. So that's the magic of the computer.
And the cross thing again, though. Simplicity that appealed to you, the directness?
So we made this track. I couldn't remember why I was talking about this track. Thank you. And so at the middle of the track, we put some church organ. Uh-huh. And because we wanted this track to feel kind of a bit of Christian, gothic, something like this.
Yeah.
But in a positive way, not in a scary way. Mm-hmm. And the chords in this track are not happy, but they have a lot of emphasis,
Drama.
Mm. Yeah, drama, positive drama.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we get this track, and Somi started to design the cover for this track, and he drew a church organ, because there was a church organ in it.
Oh, mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And he made a Justice logo to sound a bit half a heavy metal band.
Yes.
and because the T is the letter in the center of justice, it just replaced the T with a cross.
Okay.
That was a stroke of genius, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much. And what is fun is that we didn't feel like we had to keep this logo or this cross. So we just released this EP. And then for the release party, we built like a neon cross just to have like something good to look at for the party. And then we get rid of all of this and we just continue our lives. We're doing a lot of remixes and everything. And then when we finished our first album, we couldn't find an ID for the record sleeve and we couldn't find a name for the album too. And we were in Toronto and at some people's place, and there was like a mantelpiece, and they had Dark Side of the Moon on the mantelpiece. And we were looking at the record cover and we were like, yeah, like this is such a cool record cover. If only we had like a symbol or something that is strong enough that we don't have to put the name of the band or the title
and
of the album.
People would know that it was you,
And then we're like, yeah, but too bad we don't have that. So we get back to Paris, like continue with our lives. And like weeks later, we thought, of course we can do it. And we just have to put the cross that we used like 2 years ago or 3 years ago on the record cover of Nazareth. And
that's quite interesting, and I've seen this before as well. You have the solution, but you just don't you just don't realize it, and then you can spend a couple of years going, oh, I don't know what I don't. It was there all the time, but
always it's always the case.
Isn't that funny? And you have to go on the bit of a journey to actually go, no, that's what it should be, you know.
But it's so hard to think outside of the box and like in everything.
Yeah, man.
And we're talking about like mixing a record.
Yeah, you were in it.
Like you're in it. And sometimes the solution is like you just have like to get rid of something, but you can't because you become so obsessed with like details that you miss like the whole thing. And like I'm thinking of that because like when we're mixing the last album, the previous album, there was one track that we couldn't mix because it was a demo. And we tried to record it like 15 times, but it didn't sound as good as the demo. So at some point we said, okay, we're going to mix the demo.
Yeah.
And it was impossible. And it was at the end of the mixing. And we called Philippe Zdar to help us. Not for him to mix it, but just to give us some advice. And he came and he said, yeah, of course, you just have, like, we use like the same bus compressors. And because we made all the album like this, it was like set on settings that were like kind of soft. And he said, you just have to do that. And he just like pushed everything like to the max and say, okay, here it is. It sounds shit, but you get the idea. You just have like to stop thinking that this is precious and that you have your settings and everything. And he was right. You know, like sometimes you like the solution is so simple, but you try to find like many other ways and you never find it.
Yeah.
So by now, your life must have really changed. You know, you weren't struggling artists, you know, in that 3 year period. You've now made it and you are toast of the town. You know, your life must have been in a very different place. How are you feeling about it all? You know, did you feel, you know, caught up in this? Because you were the toast of the town. I mean, you were like, you were the hottest things in the world in dance music at that point.
But I honestly don't know. Like, of course, we felt that people were interested in what we were doing, but at the same time, we never like reached mainstream success. Like, even our like the we made some songs that a lot of people know, but they never charted. You know, we never like managed like a huge success. So we don't know. We don't really know what it is like to be a pop star. So in a way, we didn't really feel a change in our lives. The as characters, we don't hide, but we don't show up too much.
Yeah,
you know, it's like we do it if it's necessary, but if it's not needed, we don't do it. Never had like huge tunes, and also because of our and just on like on a very pragmatical way. Even when I was in school, we were working as graphic designers and we're already making a good living. So it's not like we make one hit, we receive like £10 million. And yeah. And all of a sudden, we see our faces like everywhere on billboards.
Yeah.
Like there was like 4 years between our first single and our first album.
Yeah.
So all of that was very progressive, and at the end, we're not so exposed. So
that's kind of good for longevity, though, isn't it?
I think it is. I think there's something really great about being respected, having success, but not being at that level where tabloid journalists are going to be sitting outside your house. And
yeah, and you say, you know, you were never pop stars, yet the last time I was at Glastonbury, you were in the head. I was when the main stage, you know, in that main stage slot, I wasn't on the main stage. I was watching you headline one of the biggest stages at Glastonbury. Mm. You know, you were in the headline slot. That's a pop star slot.
Mm.
On the same stage where I probably saw Massive Attack like 20 years before, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, but we love our like position in the musical landscape.
Mm.
Where we were able like to reach a certain amount of people and operate at big scale without having like the downside of it. And I'm thinking of the first downside is that you lose the freedom of trying things or like doing things that don't make sense. Mm. And we still have like this this freedom. Like there's another band I love for that. That's called but that's called like everybody knows MGMT. Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really love their music. I really love like their persona. Mm. And also like the position they occupy in music.
Yeah.
Like MGMT could have become like Tame Impala, for example.
Yes.
Because it's really like
pop psychedelia thing.
Trailblazed way for this. But they are like they make records and all records are always like great songs. They're always like the weirdest shit you can imagine. And it's cool. It's like it's great position to have. You can make and most of the bands I love, they are like this in the middle. Like they touch people at the same time. They are like completely free and they don't touch like so many people. So it's like you still feel you own it a bit. You know?
Yeah, I get that. No, there's a beauty in that positioning for sure.
Should we play an MGMT song?
Like anyone? Yeah.
Well, hold on. You have a Grammy, don't you? On your
Yep.
On your shelf at home that's MGMT related?
Yeah, 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 totally. Like the first one we won was for the remix of Electric Feel we did.
Yeah.
So we received like a request from the A&R of the company at the time that said, do you want to, like, we have this new hot band. This is going to be huge. Do you want to make a remix? And we already like quit more or less making remixes at the time. Mm. But we listened to it just to have an opinion and we liked it. So we say, okay, but only if we choose the song. So we choose Electric Feel. And it's an amazing song, but the metric of it is like, I don't know how it's called. I think it's like 6/8. It's not like a 4/4, you know?
Yeah.
Like the loop is like shorter. It's like 6 bars. And at the same time, we met them. And they were like, we hope you're going to make something crazy to this track. Like crazy in their sense, which means like something abstract that, you know, like that will lose people. And all we did was just to put the track back on the 4/4 and changing the song, the sounds a bit. But it's probably one of the least crazy remixes we made because we love the song. So we didn't change it too much. We just like put it in a normal, like a regular metric. And it's crazy that we won a Grammy with this. But it's good, it felt good.
Yeah, I bet it did. Let's hear it.
Let's do it. Trailblazers. Xavier Derone.
I completely forgot about the shitty intro that we made. When you receive like the stems for remixes, sometimes, and that was the case on this track, you receive like all the separate like split vocals.
Yes.
And we did a couple of remixes like that where we take like the just one take of vocal or the worst one and we put it like very upfront.
Yeah.
And we made the remix and we're like, how about we make like a shit, like the worst introduction possible to the track? So we took like the worst part of Andrew, like singing And I think we also detuned it so it sounds like out of key and put like the shittiest MIDI sound. So when the track starts, then it just like takes all the space. Yeah.
And did you do that because they wanted you to do something crazy?
And no, we've already like finished the remix when we met them, but we didn't tell them that. So it's finished and it's not crazy.
So we're starting to come closer to the modern, to current sort of life now. You settled in, I guess, to a sort of role of multiple albums, and your career moved forward. Do you have a view that you will just sort of keep making records ongoing into the foreseeable future, or do you see a point where you might go, hey, we've said what we have to say now? It's an interesting thing. Some artists, you know, kind of just keep making great records ad infinitum, and some don't. I wonder how you view your evolution as a band.
But that's the thing, is but the thing that we never know what will be next. But just because we were like graphic designers 2 minutes before we stopped being graphic designers to make music, we know that things aren't always like you expect them to be. And also there's like, because finally we only made like 3 albums in the span of like 15 years. So there's so much time happening between those records that we never know if like when we start to make another record, if we're going to like what we're doing, or if we feel we have something that sounds relevant to us to put on a record. So far, so good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are like a lot of things that we want to try, and now we're like starting again to get more into it. But also like the process we have together is that we talk continuously, even like when we don't make music, like for 2 or 3 years, we talk about what we're gonna do, and we make like folders with like ideas, or we take notes or things we want to try. So like so far it didn't happen that we come in the studio and we don't know what to do. It's like we look at each other, you know, in the eyes or whatever.
Yeah.
It didn't happen yet. But that's the thing with like music too. It's like it's a bit of a cruel world because for example, you look at filmmakers, like the older they get, the better the movies are in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And with music, I don't have like so many examples of that. It's like it's a saw tooth. Or I don't know if you can say that. Like I don't know of any musicians that has been like consistently relevant throughout a career. Sometimes it's not relevant just because it's not good. Sometimes it's because it doesn't fit with what people want to listen to at this time. Sometimes you can come back to it like 20 years later and find out that actually it was good. So like we are very well ready for that, and we already like in 3 albums we make things that people like, people don't like, or whatever. It goes on like this,
which is obviously something that you've got to be completely at peace with, the fact that whatever you do, not everybody's gonna like it, right? That's part of being an artist as well, I feel, isn't it? Accepting that whatever we do here, there's going to be somebody slagging it off. Oh, it's not as good as this. Oh, you know, that's something that has to be, you know, accepted.
I think it's a torture if you don't understand that. But it's cool. We've been very lucky because the 3 first tracks we put out was So Never Be Alone, Where Are Your Friends? Instead of like doing something like this, we'd made a Waters of Nazareth that was just like distortion and something like not friendly.
Yeah.
And when people thought we would make an album of that, we released DNC. Yeah. So we are already used with the fact that there was a lot of people that were discontent.
Yes.
Anyway, like even like before dropping our first album, there was already like some kind of like discontentment about what we're doing.
That's interesting, yeah.
And also we had like 3 ways of like having a hype, and then it like crumbles because you don't deliver what has been wanted. And they were not. It's not like if any of these tracks would have been a huge success, because if it's like 1 million sellers, then it doesn't matter whether people like it or not or whatever, you know. But no, they were like very confidential tracks, but never what people wanted from us. So at the moment we are releasing our first album, we are already like freed from the pressure of having to do something that makes sense.
Right, right.
And which was very good for like the 15 years after and even more, is that we still like do things without taking into account whether it makes sense for people who liked what we did before or not.
Yeah, hence the enormous difference between your first record and your second record. You were, you know, it's like you have liberty, don't you? It's so liberating.
Yeah.
The space that you're in to do what you wanted to do. And to do something a bit crazy.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun because like the we have requests like from artists that want us to produce tracks for them.
Yeah.
In the modern way, so it's not like production really, it's more like you make an instrumental and they sing on top of it.
Mm. Yep.
And what is fun is that they all have a different idea of what they want. Some of them want it like disco because like they know the disco tracks of us. Some of them want it like noisy. Some of them want it like EDM because they think we're an EDM band. Some of them want it like sounding like 10 years ago. But the common point they all have is that they always ask like something like that we don't do any longer.
Right.
And at the end, it's like in 90% of the cases, it's a mismatch. We don't even have to work on the track. We tell them no. Like, we think it's not. It's like a casting mistake.
Do you have much of a desire to produce other artists' records?
Only if it's interesting. We're not running after having like big featurings or whatever, and we tend to do the opposite actually when we make albums.
Mm.
And same thing with we live in a collaborative world right now.
Yeah.
But in a sense that doesn't work for us because it's like we love collaboration when I'm gonna talk like Jean-Claude Van Damme now, but when 1 + 1 = 3, but not when everybody loses his personality because you try to force something into something that might appeal to people because you think that you're gonna get the market of this one and the market of this one.
And there's so much of that philosophy, isn't there, present now in certainly in record label world, where it's like we want, you know, three different artists in the in the artist credit because three is better than two and maybe four is better than three. And sometimes it's like, oh, let's just think about, you know, the music being brilliant rather than that whole kind of stacked collaborative thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so not to answer a question, we're not like running after that.
No.
If it shows up and if we feel it's like it can be good, we give it a try, of course.
Yep.
But otherwise, no.
You've always there's always been a real momentum about you artistically. You've always kept moving forwards and you're always doing not what people, you know, you don't, like you say, you don't care about what people want. You just kind of keep moving. That's a wonderful place to be for an artist. I think that it must be very satisfying as an artist to be in that position.
We're very happy like this. And at the same time, it's not like a total rule because there are some bands I love and they kept on doing the same stuff like for like all their career. I'm thinking for like AC/DC, for example, you would be disappointed if it didn't sound like an old AC/DC track, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they do it like brilliantly, like the Strokes, same thing. Like they've been doing the same song for like 20 years, but the song is amazing. So I will keep on buying their albums, whatever they do. And it depends on the type of bands. I think for every band or every artist, there's like a different scheme. I guess the only thing is that to be happy with what you're doing, and we find happiness in like trying different things. But if we would like find happiness in doing always the same thing, we would probably do, and it wouldn't be a problem.
Tell us about what's going on now. You've been working on a film, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, well, it's a live performance film, is that right?
Yeah,
it's a controlled live performance.
Yeah, the live performance was the excuse for us to make this film that is very much like what we wanted to do with this film was to put like the audience in a state that like it's a stoner movie. I'm trying to find the good words.
It's a stoner movie.
It's a stoner movie. Like, we just want people like to watch this film. It's like very abstract. It's just like images. It's very beautiful. It's very slow. You do whatever you need to, and then you can just like indulge. It's like it's like watching like a documentary about animals. You know what I mean? You watch like a 1 hour documentary about like whales in the Antarctic.
Yeah,
and it's cool. You know, it doesn't say anything. You didn't learn anything new. But it was like such a good trip to have and to see this, and it's beautiful, and the musical experience is an excuse for us to make this film, and we are very happy with the result. It's like it's like watching a lava lamp. You know what I mean?
A lava lamp
or an aquarium. It's like it's really type of film.
Really relaxing. But it's you performing. It's your live music that is the soundtrack for this film.
Yeah. Like the other reason why we did this film is that we wanted to document our last tour, and we tried like so many times to film our shows, but it never looked the way we wanted it to look.
Yeah,
and we wanted like to have a document of the live show that is like where the focus is the music and the visual, and not the energy and not the interaction between the band and the audience.
Yeah.
Because a live show, in a proper live show, like the audience makes like 50% at least of the show. But it didn't work for us, so we wanted to have something very like slow, cold, and beautiful. So yeah, we worked on that for 1 year. And now we're just trying things. Now we're back in the studio, we're making music. With no plan, we're just like we're doing things, trying things, listening to new things, new way of making music.
Yeah, and you talked about you were always like making notes and like I imagine like a mood board of pictures and things like that. You know, what are some of the moods and notes that are informing where you are now?
It can be anything. There are like words, so I have like notes on my phone with words. It can be images, sensations.
Yeah.
But it's most of the time about sensations, and because we are very like connected, when we talk about sensations, we know it means the same thing to us. So we talk about that, and also about like aesthetic in general. But the thing, and I think we learned that from graphic design, is that any type of aesthetic can be applied to another medium. There's always a way of translating an emotion or something into another media. I don't know if it's clear, but you can hear some music and make an image out of it.
Absolutely.
You can see an image and find a way of giving the same emotion with music. And it works with everything. It can be with furnitures, with people, with the way you feel when you see someone. Mm. Stuff like this. So this is the type of notes we have.
Fantastic. Well, before we ask you the last question, let's just pick one song that you are really proud of from your live set, from that film, from Iris, to play now.
Like I love Chorus on the live set, and it's a nice example of the gap that there is between Justice album and Justice live. So Chorus on the album is like kind of like, it's not prog track, but it's there's a drive. It's like very melodic and it's a bit like a hazy.
Mm.
And for the live version, we got rid of everything. We just kept two sounds and made like a industrial techno track. There's like no music at all in it. It's just like a rhythm.
Yeah.
And it was so good to play it live because it's one of the moments where people actually get to dance in the live show.
Yeah.
And when everything is like predictable, like things drop when you want them to drop.
There's your elegant deconstruction again. All right, Chorus, but the live version.
Trailblazers. Xavier Durone.
So, the way that we round things off with everybody is that we put them into this scenario where the Earth is in danger, where aliens have come and they are building some kind of like superhighway, and they are looking at they're surveying this neck of the cosmic woods, and they are deciding which planets in our solar system to destroy in order to make way for this. So if those aliens come, what is the tune that you would play to them to make them to make them think that we are worth saving? So it is the tune to save the world. It's high pressure shit, Xavier.
Yeah. The tune I picked is so it's an edit, and I can't remember if I made this edit or if I got it like handed to me like this. Mm. It's not an edit. It's like it's a Surf's Up by Brian Wilson.
Oh,
but on the you know when you buy like the whole record. Like the new edition of it, that was like released like 10 years ago, something like this. You had like the demo, the instrumental, like many different versions. And this is an edit that starts with a demo instrumental and that then goes into like the demo with vocals that he sang. So there's none of like the actual studio version. And it works so well because it starts with like 2 minutes or so of like a very beautiful, yet like... it's just very beautiful music, and then it just like calms down, and then you have him like singing, and it's like the most, like for me, it's like the most beautiful song probably ever written, and this is like the ultimate version to listen to this song.
So why is it gonna stop? Why is this gonna stop them from blowing up this planet?
Because it's beautiful, and
so you're trying to appeal to them. In an emotional way.
I mean, it's either you play them that or you play them something like awful so they run away. Because, you know what I mean?
We back to metal.
So what do we do? Like we try to
be beauty good wins.
I think
beauty
positive, wins. I think positivity. Yeah. I think positivity has got to win. The force is always going to win over the dark side. Mm. So with that in mind, let's have the wonderful Brian Wilson.
Trailblazers, Xavier Durone. The diamond necklace played the pawn, hand in hand some drummed along, whoa, to a handsome man at baton. A blind class aristocracy, back through the opera glass, you see the pit and the pendulum drum.
It's been a fantastic opportunity to talk to you. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks for coming to Paris.
Well, we love it here, and we look forward to seeing you wherever it is around. Is there going to be more live bits and pieces out and about?
Yeah, what's on the horizon for you?
No. Like we have this rule is that when we stop playing live, we don't play live anymore. Whatever is at stake.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so after the last gig, we dismantle everything.
Right.
So, and it's a good thing. So, like, even if, like, 2 weeks after, somebody calls us, like, I have, like, $10 million to play, like, we can't do it. Like, we don't even have, like, to wonder, like, is it good, is it bad, or whatever. We just can't do it.
So, it's a really steadfast rule.
Until you're...
Until there's, like, 20 millions
right.
on okay. the line, and then we say, like, okay, we're going to rebuild it.
Okay. Yeah.
So that means, is that just so that you don't get distracted, so that you can just get your head down and concentrate on life and then on your next record?
Yeah, but the thing is that it's not so easy, but it can be easy to tour forever if you're lucky. And it's difficult sometimes to say no to things because they bring you a certain sort of comfort or whatever. Mm. And then you look again and it's been like 10 years we've been doing that.
And you missed your kid growing up because you're a dad now.
Yeah, you miss this, you miss like just like normal life. and you are sick and tired of like playing like every night or whatever.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of people in that case. So now we decide, and at the beginning, we set this rule because we didn't want to become alcoholics.
Yeah, that as well, actually. Can be part of the... You get too much into that lifestyle, it can be a problem.
Yeah, totally. You know, like we knew that, okay, we're going to set a limit date, but otherwise we're going to get crazy. And also, like, when you tour in good conditions, you are completely, like, taken in charge of.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a bubble.
And there's a risk of, like, debilitation from that, you know what I mean? Like, we just try to scan, like, all possibilities. We're like, okay, maybe it's more reasonable that we decide to stop at some point and we do it whatever happens.
That is very wise. Xavier. It was lovely to see you again.
Yeah.
Great to see you in Paris.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Same.
And bonne chance and happy, and please send love to Gaspard. And,
I will.
And I hope that, I can't wait to hear, you know, whenever the new stuff comes, man. Until then,
you enjoy
your coffee and your croissant tomorrow and your time in the studio and your time at home with your family.
Thank you very much.
Thanks man. Yeah. Catch you later. Cheers.
Trailblazers. Deezer. Originals.